The day Colin Powell attended the Security Council through a propaganda speech, he presented some very important documents revealing Iraq's secret attempts to gain access to nuclear weapons of mass destruction. No one could believe that he could be lying so skillfully, interweaving reality with fabrication and reaching a very incorrect conclusion. Up until that time, Colin Powell was known to be a reasonable individual with exemplary military discipline, someone who could not easily lie without his voice trembling or his complexion changing. But in that conference and at that time, he easily and ruthlessly elicited false conclusions from real documents that led to the murder of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians and plunged Americans into a fatal war.
You know, somebody once said that credibility, like virtue, is not lost on a temporary basis. And Colin Powell destroyed himself in that famous session at the United Nations where he held up the aerial photographs, you remember?
But Colin Powell, when he made that case at the UN, which was a decisive testimony in gaining support for the Iraq war and leading to the invasion, that was a major factor in allowing the United States to invade Iraq. Colin Powell did that knowing that that evidence was fabricated.
We had no reason to invade Iraq. And as a result of that, Americans figure this is the Colin Powell, you know, if you break it, you own it. Well, that's not the way one should act morally. If you make a mistake, you back up, you stop the mistake, and you pull out. That's what we've never done as part of our policy in Iraq. And so we continue to brutalize the Iraqi society.
The truth is, the documents Colin Powell was referring to in that session really did exist. Saddam and the Iraqi administration were seeking to gain access to nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons for many years. But these documents belong to a period when Iraq was at war with Iran. Back then, Iraq was greatly supported by the American government and other Western countries. Still recall pictures of Rumsfeld and Saddam's historical meeting. Yet after Iraq's war against Iran, the U.S. policies towards Iraq changed, especially after the First Persian Gulf War. Saddam was no longer to remain in power in Iraq, and he was supposed to destroy the great amount of weapons he had obtained during the 8-year war with Iran, some of which were extremely dangerous. This was accomplished in a 10-year period.
Photograph of Donald Rumsfeld, who during the Reagan period was a special emissary of the White House, in Baghdad, arm in arm with Saddam Hussein, having gone there to provide Iraq with chemical weapons.
Clearly, there are a number of factors. One was obviously oil and control of those resources. Saddam Hussein was considered a thorn in the U.S. side in that region. He was considered a threat to the U.S. ally in Israel. There was a personal side to it because he had Saddam Hussein had been seen as offending the Bush family.
Now we know now, and they knew then, that there weren't any weapons of mass destruction. We know now, and they knew then, that there were no ties between Iraq and Al Qaeda. It was just a target of opportunity. Iraq had been decimated in the Gulf War. They had no real army anymore. They had been subject to very, very stringent sanctions. Their defenses were non-existent, really. And so when Dick Cheney and George Bush, both of them from the oil men folks, looked at the needs, the felt needs of our country, and saw the need for oil, a diminishing resource, a non-replenished resource, they looked at Iraq and said, there's a country that has the second or third largest deposits of oil under their sands, and they've got a ruthless dictator. That's a good thing. And besides, the Israelis really would like us to have some regime change there.
Well, the United States, they had to. In order for me to take intelligence information to Israel, I had to get the approval of the CIA. And so every time before I went to Israel, I would sit down with the CIA and say, this is what I'm going over to do. These are the questions I'm going to ask. And when I came back, I would tell the CIA, this is some of the information that I was given. Not all the information, but basically because as an American citizen, I'm not allowed to engage in independent intelligence relationships with other nations. So yes, everything I did as a weapons inspector was known to the U.S. government. You know, by 1996, I was 5 years into an effort to disarm Iraq, and we were on the cusp, we were on the verge of being able to say there are no weapons of mass destruction left. All we need to do is dot a couple I's, cross a couple T's, and this thing's done. So I wasn't going to run away in 96. I struggled for 2 more years along with the other inspectors to get the truth out. It became apparent, however, in 98 that the U.S. just didn't want to hear the truth, that all the U.S. wanted to do was to provoke confrontation.
The role of Israel as the main cause of recent events in the Middle East and initiator of war in the region is highlighted. Israelis are masters in declaring war with a fake flag. After the bitter event of September 11th, the Israeli prime minister of the time was the first person to show a meaningful reaction. He considered this ominous incident as the cause of great calamities in the world. Having precise information about Iraq and Afghanistan, they tried to establish common interests with the White House and other European governments to reach a common conclusion to attack the Middle East region.
If Israel had attacked Iraq, we would have lost all of our bases in the coalition, because no Arab country is going to be on the same side as Israel attacking another Arab country. The Israelis knew that.
After 9/11 was really influenced by that and wanted to do everything I could to protect the people I cared about and kind of from the different leaders that I trusted and the people that I looked up to.
But I fear that once the American people see that their interests are being placed second to the interests of this small country that has no respect for international law, much less human rights, and that their soldiers, their sons and daughters, are dying because of this, I really fear that there's going to be a backlash.
I bought into the whole scene of that, you know, we're over there, we're helping them, we're protecting them from these so-called insurgents. And so I went over there feeling that I was doing good. I was doing such an honorable thing, you know.
And what did you find?
I found out quickly that my beliefs were wrong. It was almost the complete opposite.
Unveiling the hidden hands of power, if not the shadow government in America, for starting two bloody wars in the Middle East reminds Americans of the bitter memories of the two world wars and the similar role of the U.S. in both. Now, with hundreds of thousands of people dead and injured in Iraq and Afghanistan, serious questions are being raised. And gradually, the real motives behind the wars are coming out of the dark.
Well, I started to look at it historically. Where were we the good guys? I couldn't find an instance where we were really the good guys. Even the great example it's always put up where we defeated the Nazis in World War II. We knew about Pearl Harbor and let it happen so that we could get into the war. We were making money off the war the whole time beforehand and even after the war.
We start the process in Iraq, which becomes the base from which we extend a program of regime change throughout the Middle East, which will make us a base where we can control the flow of oil, guarantee Israel's security, and make this regime change. 1996, they had already decided that they wanted to get rid of this guy because he was perceived. Cheney signed that, Rumsfeld signed that, Scooter Libby signed that.
You know, what the American people were sold, why we went in there, was because there was weapons of mass destruction that was in Iraq that was an imminent threat to, you know, U.S. citizens. Well, we found out very quickly that that was not the case. There was no nuclear weapons found. There was no major caches of biological or other type of weapons there. So the reason that we went there in the first place was mute within the first 3 or 4 months. So why we've been there all along now, it's all good questions. It has to be around.
Right now, the number one public opinion in America is angry at everybody in Washington. Angry at Democrats, angry at Republicans, and they're angry at a lot of people in New York, angry at banks, angry at Wall Street. In the scheme of all those things, the cost of our missions in the Middle East are part of the problem, but not the major part.
The Zionist politicians who play a significant role in planning American and British foreign policies program and propagandize illusory threats in each period to win the illegitimate benefits of capitalistic circles. At the time of the Soviet Union, they introduced the threat of communist expansion as an excuse to encroach and plunder Middle Eastern resources. Later on, they used Islamophobia as a pretext to achieve their aims, as they tried to disguise themselves as democratic and humanitarian.
During that period, a prominent British intelligence official named Dr. Bernard Lewis, who also happens to be a leading Zionist, came to the United States from Britain, and he became very influential initially with Zbigniew Brzezinski and Samuel Huntington, who were the national security team under Jimmy Carter. And later, he became a key intellectual advisor to the entire neoconservative apparatus, and particularly to Secretary of Defense and later Vice President Dick Cheney. And Bernard Lewis basically urged the idea of promoting Islamic fundamentalism all along the southern tier of the Soviet Union as a strategy against the Soviet Union.
The Bush administration and now the Obama administration, they need a pretext, they need a justification, some rationale that would explain to the people here in the United States why they should spend $1 billion every 2 days to occupy Iraq and Afghanistan, why they should send their young people to go and kill people they don't know and be killed by them.
And you look at the Palestinians, and when they vote for a certain party that we don't like, we cut off relations with the Palestinians. So that's not promoting democracy either. So we're inconsistent on that. We're inconsistent in sometimes supporting countries that are not democracies. We're inconsistent when people do vote in ways we don't like. We ignore them and treat them badly.
It takes up a huge part of our economy. Half of our discretionary budget is spent on the military now. And the United States spends more on the military than the next 15 countries in the world combined. And so this is, in a way, it's pathological thinking. It's a sort of sickness that we have. And we part of the pathology is we can't understand that it's a sickness, right? We have to learn this.
Today, the concept of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq is a joke to U.S. soldiers and military commanders in Iraq. Americans regret trusting their politicians and try to compensate this mistake by making practical movements. The day the American people decide to punish those who started such bloody wars will be a very ugly day for American officials.
Right now, the number one public opinion in America is angry at everybody in Washington. Angry at Democrats, angry at Republicans, and they're angry at a lot of people in New York, angry at banks, angry at Wall Street. In the scheme of all those things, the cost of our missions in the Middle East are part of the problem, but not the major part.
But, you know, the word weapons of mass destruction was kind of a joke to the officers when we were there. You know, it was never a part of our mission to look for weapons of mass destruction. What was a part of our mission was going to the oil fields and making sure that we defended the oil fields. So really in the first weeks, it was very obvious that, you know, the mission had nothing to do with finding these, you know, these weapons of mass destruction. And it had a very different reason.
They twisted things and picked some very pliable people like George Tenet, who was the head of the CIA at the time, and said, hey, we'd like to make a war on Iraq. And so we'd like you to drum up some evidence so that we can persuade the American people that there's a threat from Iraq. You think he could do that? And to his eternal discredit, what he should have said is, we don't do that kind of thing. Instead of that, he said, yes, sir. And he instructed the people in my part of the CIA to drum up evidence.
The administration really wasn't concerned about weapons of mass destruction. If we go back and reconstruct the history of WMD, we'll find and weapons inspections, we'll find that the decision by the Security Council to create a resolution 687 back in April of 1991, calling for Iraq's disarmament, was less about weapons of mass destruction and more about continuing a economic sanctions regime that was designed to destabilize and undermine Saddam Hussein to facilitate his eventual demise. This was the true policy objective of the United States from the very beginning. It was never about weapons of mass destruction. It was always about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. The weapons inspection process was useful only so far as it facilitated regime change. If we actually became focused on weapons inspections, we became inconvenient.
With prevailing circumstances, the presence of U.S. troops in the region no longer has sound reason or public interest for the area or for Americans themselves. This is the reason behind the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, as American officials have also admitted.
There's three types of people that support these wars. The people that benefit from them, the people that haven't been there, or the people that are just stupid and don't have a clue in their own mind what's going on.
So there's no clearly articulated reason why we have to fight in Iraq, why we have to fight in Afghanistan. There's no mission. There's just kind of, we have to go and try to stay alive. So the majority of soldiers right now don't want to die. They want to see their families. They don't want to lose their legs, right? They want to see their children grow up. And they're being made to go over and over again to fight in these horrible wars.
In the case of Afghanistan, we got into a quagmire. This is the longest war that the United States has been engaged in its entire history. And there's right now very minimal public support for the continued U.S. presence, even within the ranks of the U.S. military. There's a sense that there's no genuine strategic objective or mission for staying in Afghanistan, and, you know, frankly, we're there because we got stuck there.
We'll be right back. Vietnam's current situation could teach the White House leaders a lesson. Not only did America's military interference have no benefit for the Vietnamese, but it also brought about irreparable damages to both countries whose sad memories will never disappear. America should have learned from that experience and should have known that not only would its military withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan not be to the detriment of these countries, rather, like in Vietnam, it would bring peace and prosperity to the people there.
So now you have a country economically is prospering. It's a communist country. And so when you look back and you say, well, why did we kill 3 million Southeast Asians? Why did we kill 58,000 Americans when there's been no change? It's still because we were doing it for political reasons, and there's been no change.
President Bush stood up in front of on the cameras and said, we're going to overthrow the Taliban because they're so terrible that, you know, women have no rights, and it's these fanatical religious leaders, now they're working with them. They're asking them to sign peace treaties, to take them in and accept them into a coalition government. So, I mean, I think whenever the United States soldiers witness that, they'll say, well, why are we dying?
Then with the first Gulf War and the present Gulf War and the Americans, and all, it's all in vain. Because after it's all said and done, we will be out of there. It will be their country, and they will do what they want to do. And more than likely, it will be a capitalist market economy. So nothing will have changed. So they're dying in vain there, and the same thing applies to Afghanistan. When we say that we went into Iraq for oil, but we told the American people, we're there to bring democracy to Iraq. Well, that's somewhat of a joke. We're in Afghanistan to bring democracy. It's not going to happen.
Of course, there are some differences between America's current war in the Middle East and the Vietnam War. At the time of the Vietnam War, the draft was compulsory and the entire nation had to participate in war. The burden of war and its dangers affected all American families. Everyone was influenced. But now that the draft is on voluntary basis, only poor families are forced to send their children to war due to economic pressure. And only these families suffer from the damages of war. Thus, the entire burden of the war is shouldered by a very small percentage of Americans.
Of the 3 million people in the military community, which includes active duty as well as reserve components, National Guards, and spouses, who are being asked to make sacrifices for the rest of the country. And that 1% is bearing all the burden. And I think a lot of folks would agree that that is certainly wrong. Back way before my time in World War II, there was rationing of gasoline. There was turn off your lights on Tuesday to save electricity for the troops. There was collecting tin cans and newspapers. Exactly, and that's how you have a successful war, is by engaging the civilians, the whole population of the U.S. and not just the 1% that's in the active duty.
Less than 1% of the American public is serving in the armed forces. That is the smallest percentage of the public serving the armed forces in the history of the United States. So what does that mean? What that means is that a very small sliver of the public is shouldering a tremendous burden and paying a tremendous price for American foreign policy at this point. So what does that mean? That is why these soldiers and Marines are coming back so damaged. We've never in the history of the United States sent soldiers basically on and off to war for 10 years straight.